Has this ever happened to you? You wake up, look at your phone, scroll through the news for a minute or two, and then think, wow, how did we get here? Well, that's the question we tackle every week on NPR's Throughline podcast. We tell you the surprising stories of the people who made our history.
Carl Sagan was in people's living rooms talking about the wonders of the universe, making science feel personal and important to an everyday person.
Listen to Throughline from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
A giant AI data center in the United Arab Emirates. That's the plan, assuming just a few things fall into place.
An intense amount of money, a lot of luck, a lot of grid infrastructure that we're still waiting on the supply chain to catch up on, and many millions of GPUs.
I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also today, recycling is down for the eighth straight year, and a song contest known for campy entertainment was once used by Spain's Francisco Franco as propaganda. The story of a singer who stood up to him.
People remember her as a rebel, a freedom fighter.
Plus the music of street vendors in Mexico City.
Se compra colchones.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for joining us this Friday. President Trump has been in the Persian Gulf this week, cutting a lot of deals in the desert.
Yesterday, a big project was announced coming out of Trump's meeting with Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan in the United Arab Emirates, a deal to build the biggest AI data center outside of the U.S. in Abu Dhabi. And this deal in particular is raising eyebrows. The amount of energy required to power the data centers is enormous. Sebastian Moss knows what it would take to build something like that. He's the editor-in-chief of Data Center Dynamics based in the U.K.
I can give you an idea of how big it could be, but I think that a lot of us are still uncertain about how many of these mega projects will reach their full scale. Mm-hmm. But an intense amount of money, you know, many, many tens and tens of billions, a lot of luck, a lot of grid infrastructure that we're still waiting on the supply chain to catch up on, and many millions of GPUs.
Will be required to build this center.
The thing is, so it's not one data center. It's going to be a bunch of different data centers on the same campus, by the looks of it, run by different companies. But again, who those companies are and whether they'll sign up is it's very much up in the air.
Okay. So you said there's still a lot of questions. What do we know about, you know, what actually is firm in this agreement?
We know that they've got 10 square miles for it. We know they've got a name for it. We know the company that will be kind of leading the project of building it. So that's the Emirati company, G42. We don't know who they're going to be working with on the US side. The government said, hey, it's going to be with the US hyperscalers. Includes Microsoft, Google, Amazon, you know, the big names. But none of them have actually come forward and said, we're doing this, we're partnering on this.
Mm, okay, so you mentioned those U.S. companies. What, in theory, would actually be happening on this campus once it's completed or once, you know, some of the data centers are completed?
Presumably, by the way they're pitching it, you'd carve off a portion for, say, Microsoft. Microsoft would own several of the facilities on the campus, whether they use it for training AI, inferencing the models, or some kind of mixture is, again, unknown.
What does a megascale data center actually allow AI to do better that smaller data centers do not?
Essentially, the more data and the more computers you stick together and throw out the AI, the better AI you can get out of it. So this is why OpenAI is trying to spend literally $500 billion on building these giant data centers.
Okay. But the idea is that these big U.S. companies could use this computing power for their AI operations.
Yeah. Yeah. And Microsoft would be the front runner if you're going to guess who's going to be part of it, because they've worked with G42 a lot. They've invested $1.5 billion in them. There's a lot of links that go back between those two.
One thing that does seem significant is that the U.S. is giving the UAE expanded access to advanced AI chips. I'm reading that they will be using NVIDIA chips in the computers at this facility. Why is that significant?
Yeah. So there was... Under the Biden admin, there was a real effort to try and stop the chips leaving the US and especially going to China. So they brought in these diffusion laws that were going to come in pretty much now. that would have blocked, made it really hard to get these chips outside of the US and, you know, some of its closest allies. And the UAE was right in the middle of that. You know, G42 was right in the middle of that, where they used to have a lot of close ties to China. They used to be invested in ByteDance. They used to work with Huawei. And over the past year or so, they pivoted to the US. And Trump at the same time has dropped these restrictions and said, hey, have at it as long as you stay in our sphere. So it's, you can have as many of these NVIDIA chips.
So the diffusion law you mentioned, meaning that a third party like or a third country like the UAE couldn't sell these chips to China.
Or couldn't even get them. They would have a limit of how many they could import into their own country, because the fear was that down the line they would somehow end up in China, or they would rent them out to Chinese companies from UAE or wherever based data centers.
And has that fear been alleviated due to some policy changes or anything like that?
With G42 specifically, it's been a very clear, you know, they've openly said, hey, we were trying to play both sides and now we're going all in on America. G42 are a fascinating company with so many different interesting ties. You know, they're building out nearly $1 billion worth of supercomputers in the US. The NVIDIA chips, very expensive. You get an NVIDIA server, it costs as much as maybe a house. There's another company that goes for building really, really massive chips. They're bigger than a dinner plate, but each one costs several million.
Wow.
Called Cerebras. And G42 is spending $900 million on 9 supercomputers in the US with these massive chips. I got to hold one once and was very, very scared.
They trusted you with that?
I was. I was like, if I drop this, that's generational debt.
I'm curious about the location. This campus is supposed to be built out in the middle of the desert. What kind of environmental impact will it have? I know that data centers require a lot of water in addition to massive amounts of energy.
If you were going to pick a place in the world to put a data center, it's not where you'd really want to put one. It's very hot. These facilities will require a lot of water.
Water for cooling, right?
Yeah, water for cooling. Because if you think about this, 5 gigawatts of power is just being converted into heat. And that heat has to be rejected from the data center, otherwise it will melt the servers. The companies do a really good job at hiding how much water they use.
Mm-hmm.
The Lawrence Berkeley National Lab at the Department of Energy do these long, multi-year research reports into how much water the data centers use. They're still within the report saying, hey, we're guessing, we don't know.
Got it. So not good data on that yet. What about this deal do you find most interesting?
Sorry, I was just thinking. I was sighing.
You were sighing.
The challenge for journalists and people right now is trying to work out what is real with AI. What's hallucinations, right? From the consumer side, you see an image and you're like, is this a hallucination? For me, as a data center journalist, I'm stuck with trying to work out how many of these projects are hallucinations. You know, we saw on the first Trump term, a lot of big projects get announced that didn't happen. So with this, it's trying to pick apart how much of this is he's doing a global tour. Everyone wants to have the biggest announcement, the biggest number. They need to beat what the Saudis announced. They need to beat what France announced earlier this year. And it's just, let's get the biggest number up on the board. And then hopefully we can work out how to get there. But that's a tomorrow problem.
Sebastian Moss is the editor-in-chief of Data Center Dynamics, based in the UK.
Something in the media coverage of President Trump's visit to the UAE has piqued curiosity across the globe. When the U.S. president landed at the Zayed International Airport in Abu Dhabi, locals greeted him with a performance.
Two rows of performers left a path for Trump to walk between them. Men held raised swords, and young women in white dresses flipped their long hair from side to side, keeping in time with a steady drumbeat. A similar scene played out at the UAE's presidential palace.
The tradition is called Alayla. It's a symbol of national identity, performed during weddings and other important occasions. People sometimes chant poetry, too.
It's been part of Emirati and Omani culture for years and was recognized by UNESCO as an intangible cultural heritage of humanity in 2014.
For Eurovision fans, suspense is building. The winner of the International Song Contest will be announced tomorrow night in Switzerland, this year's host country. 37 countries have been competing. The Eurovision people know and love today is a massive production with crazy pageantry and pyrotechnics. But back in 1968, singers just sang. Even so, there was major intrigue that year. The World's Jerry Hadden brings us the story from Barcelona.
The story, it unfolds like a TV series, which is why they've just made it into one. It's called La Canción, or The Song. It opens with an actor playing the elderly dictator Francisco Franco out hunting pheasants.
No nos quieren, ministro. Ahí fuera nunca nos han querido.
Nobody loves us, he laments to a general by his side. The outside world never has. Sure, people come for the sunshine and beaches, he says, but they end up focusing on the three or four college students staging protests. Under Franco, protesting for democracy usually led to police beatings, prison, or worse. But Franco longed for the world to see Spain differently, as a modern, open country. My wife loves that song contest, he continues. You know, the one where everyone's talking in English and French. Eurovision, a general says. That's it, says Franco. If we could win that, people might like us. His message to the general is clear. Bring me a win. What ensues is a nail-biting race against time to find the perfect singer and the perfect song. In charge is Spain's Eurovision artistic director, an Austrian named Artur Kaps. Kaps was brought in for his connections and influence across Europe. In the television series, when a young bureaucrat asks Kaps how they'll know if a song is a winner, that's easy, Kaps says. If days later people are still humming it in their heads, that's the one. After an exhaustive countrywide search, they land on the demo of a song called La La La.
They needed a song that was politically correct, that didn't say something very concrete, so La 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 was a good thing.
This is Spanish-German actor Alex Brendemühl, who plays Caps in the series.
They needed also an artist who, in terms of representing Spain, was a correct person, like Catholic, and an image that should correspond to the moral of the Spanish at that time.
Their first choice, the young rising star Juan Manuel Serrat.
He was good enough to represent Spain because he wasn't like, he didn't have like long hair, was a complete hippie.
But Serrat would only sing in his native Catalan. Franco had essentially banned Catalan from public life, so just 10 days before the contest, Serrat gets the boot. After a mad scramble, Caps and his team find a young last-minute replacement named Maciel. She's good, but that year she's up against none other than British superstar Cliff Richard. Richard goes first with congratulations, but then Maciel crushes it.
Ladies and gentlemen, the winner of the Eurovision Song Contest 1968 is Spain!
Spain wins, and by extension, Franco. For about 30 seconds, says Alex Brendemühl.
Somehow it wasn't a real triumph because Maciel refused to be the image of the Franco regime.
In the series, moments after taking the trophy, Maciel is asked to pose with Franco for a photo and accept his Medal of Honor.
No voy a ir al Pardo a sacarme una foto con Franco.
When she realized what it implied and what they wanted her to symbolize, she said, no, I am myself. I am unique and I am not singing for politics.
So Franco never got to celebrate. He died 7 years later. As for Maciel, her lasting legacy, that of a sort of cultural Trojan horse who caught Western Europe's last fascist regime by surprise.
I think still people remember her as a rebel, as an icon, a freedom fighter, and she wasn't scared about going to jail or anything.
Exactly 10 years after Maciel's victory, Spain finally got the approval Franco had been chasing by becoming a democracy. La La La. For the World. I'm Sherry Haddon, Barcelona.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. A court case happening now has Australians talking.
Obviously, as you know, I've been thinking far too much about the mushroom killer trials.
Okay, so I'm back in my car now. So you can go into the courtroom, but it was already full.
This case is absolutely insane.
It is a case of murder by poisonous mushroom. A woman is on trial in the Australian town of Morwell for feeding her in-laws beef Wellington laced with deadly fungi. The trial has been a real spectacle. The World's Sarah Birnbaum explains.
In July of 2023, Erin Patterson hosted a lunch at her home in a small, pretty town in Victoria. She invited her estranged husband, his parents, and his aunt and uncle. The husband backed out at the last minute, but the rest of them went. Beef Wellington was on the menu, so that's beef tenderloin wrapped in prosciutto, puff pastry, and mushrooms. And these mushrooms were ones Patterson foraged herself, though she denied it at first. A week later, three of her lunch guests were dead with mushroom poisoning. A fourth was in the hospital in critical condition. He survived. Erin Patterson was charged with murder and attempted murder. She says she's innocent and seemed really broken up when she spoke to reporters outside her house in August of 2023.
I'm devastated. I love them. And I can't believe that this has happened, and I'm so sorry that they have lost their lives.
Now the trial is underway, and many Australians are absolutely obsessed. One woman wrote on Reddit that she's downloading trial transcripts every night. Australia's national broadcaster and The Guardian have live blogs from inside the courtroom. And The Mushroom Case Daily is the number one podcast on Australia's true crime podcast chart.
I'll be there for every day of this murder case. I'll be your eyes and ears in the courtroom. So join
there are no cameras or recording equipment, but I'll sum it up. The defense hasn't testified yet, but so far things aren't looking so good for Erin Patterson. The jury heard evidence that in order to get her in-laws to her house, she told them she had cancer and she needed advice on how to tell the kids. And that's why it was very important that the kids not be there. Turns out she was never diagnosed with cancer. She made it up, which she admits. Then the jury heard she put the beef Wellington for her guests on gray plates, but she put her own portion on a different plate, an orange one. Then once everyone got sick, Patterson went to the hospital and told them she had gastrointestinal symptoms, but then she refused medical treatment and discharged herself against medical advice. The prosecution claims she was faking in order to cover up what she did. The defense says she was scared of hospitals. In a video podcast, Guardian Australia's court reporter Nino Bucci lays out the lies Erin Patterson told.
Such as taking that dehydrator that was used for the mushrooms and taking that to the tip.
That means landfill.
And then later telling police she never owned a dehydrator. Telling police she never foraged for mushrooms and instead actually telling multiple people, health authorities, people from council, her own family, that she'd got the mushrooms for those beef Wellingtons from Woolworths and also from an Asian grocer.
The defense says Patterson panicked, and that's why she told the lies. It doesn't mean she's guilty. The judge has said there are two questions before the jury. Did Erin Patterson intentionally put death cap mushrooms in those beef Wellingtons? And if the answer to that is yes, then did she mean to kill or seriously harm her lunch guests when she did that? The trial continues next week. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
A new museum has just opened in the Netherlands in the city of Rotterdam. It's called the Phoenix. Everything in it relates to migration. And it opens at a time when anti-migrant sentiment is on the rise in Europe. Efrat Zahavi is one of the featured artists at the new museum. She's originally from Haifa, Israel, but lives now in Rotterdam.
Well, I live in Rotterdam for 23 years now. And I work with plasticine. It's like the modeling clay, you know, the colorful modeling clay. Mm-hmm. It's a material that always stays soft. And I'm making portraits of people on the street. So I actually ask people, I don't know if they can sit with me for 1 hour or something like this. And on location, in a cafe or in the park, I clay them and I interview them about where they came from and the family story. Because in Rotterdam, like 50% of the population are migrants.
Including you.
Including me, yeah.
What have people been saying about the museum in terms of a museum devoted to migration opening up now in Rotterdam? What do people think about that as a theme?
For me, as an artist, as a migrant, I think it's fantastic. I mean, the museum itself, its architecture is amazing. It's on a world class.
As I understand it, it's on a wharf in Rotterdam, on sort of a dock on the water in Rotterdam. And on the top, it looks like a regular building, and then on top it has this kind of double helix going up, which starts in the building that you can walk up and out of the building. Describe that.
Yeah, it's they call it the tornado, and it's made from reflecting aluminium, so it's like glass. When I walked on the stairs, I felt a bit like I'm on a ship because of the glass. You have like water reflex from the sky. So I really felt the movement, even that it's not moving. And you have amazing skyline. It's not New York, but it's a beautiful Rotterdam skyline. Just what you see from when you are on the top, it's also very amazing view.
Do you think a museum dedicated to and focused on migration is necessary right now?
Extremely necessary. Europe losing its mind, at least that's how I see it. I mean, I hear politicians saying things that I think I live now in the 30s. And, you know, I'm a grandchild of two grandmas that were refugees, one of from Italy, one from Holland. I had a grandma that was Dutch. And when I came 23 years ago to Europe, I thought, wow, if there is one place where you are safe and can feel at home as migrant, where they learn from the past, then it's here in Europe. And so it's so good to see that there is this museum that shows migration in its positive side. We can, like Anna Kremers is the directrice of the museum, and she said, there is no humanity without migration.
I'm curious, you're an artist, and has your art always focused on migrants and telling their stories, or did you shift to that focus for the purpose of this museum?
I didn't shift for the museum, but it was not always my subject. My subject is more human interest. Maybe it's not the museum that changed me, it's Rotterdam, because suddenly I live in a city where I can talk to Arabic people, Muslim people, you know, in my neighborhood, a lot of people from Morocco, Turkish background, and Syrian refugees. So I was really curious to know the other people. And migration, of course, connect to it in indirect way.
Efrat Zahavi is an artist based in Rotterdam. Her work is featured in the city's new museum dedicated to migration. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Look on the flip side of many disposable containers and you'll see a symbol letting you know how to recycle it. That's become a pretty standard part of consumer life. So it might seem like recycling is something everyone does. But the recycling rate has actually been declining for 8 straight years. And that's a global trend, according to a new report by Circle Economy, a nonprofit based in Amsterdam. Matthew Fraser is with Circle Economy. And when he joined us today from São Paulo, Brazil, he explained the metric his team used in the report.
A circularity gap metric is what we call it. It measures the fraction of secondary materials or recycled materials flowing back into the global economy. So what we've seen is back in 2018, the economy was 9.1% circular, so roughly 10% of everything we consume has come from secondary materials. That number has gone down to just 6.9%. So it has been a reasonably sharp drop in just about seven, eight years.
So what does this decline in recycling look like? I mean, in terms of human behavior, what seems to be changing?
I think there are a few things. So I would also make a distinction between the circularity gap metric that I just mentioned, that 6.9%, and recycling. So actually, the recycling rate itself indeed has been going down over the past couple of years. Globally, it's 27%. So the global recycling rate itself is 27%. However, there are other factors driving the circularity metric, which is a more input side metric. Increased extraction, so the sheer volume of materials that we extract as a global economy has gone up. It's well over 100 billion tons every single year. The amount of materials that we contribute to stocks, so things like bridges, roads, vehicles, buildings, all of those, they're being locked into our economy. But also the rate of some specific materials have been going up over the past couple of years specifically.
Huh. So is this happening in certain parts of the world and not others?
I think each part of the world is quite different. So obviously, if you look at, let's say, Western economies, we have very high standards of living. So we consume a lot. Most of us have two cars, a decent-sized home. In other parts of the world, they don't share those same luxuries and that same level of consumption. If you look at it, actually, most, let's say, Western countries and highly developing, so quickly developing countries, are really responsible for the majority of the consumption.
So is part of the problem that there's not enough places to recycle, and so the increase in the amount that needs to be recycled, when that's going up, there's not the other end of it in terms of places to recycle, or is it just behavior?
I think there are a few things. So first of all, the complexity of a lot of materials that exist today did not exist 60 or 70 years ago. So think of much more simple materials, bio-based materials, plastics, and much more complex composite materials. If you imagine, for example, a t-shirt produced today, it's probably a blend of maybe, you know, three or four or maybe even more different types of materials, whereas a t-shirt 50 years ago was just cotton. I think that poses a very real challenge in terms of how we're able to recover materials. That's one side of it. The other side is that it's far easier just to buy something new rather than to repair or otherwise extend the life of the goods that we already have in many cases.
What consequences do you foresee if this trend of recycling less continues?
I think obviously there's valuable materials that are all around us. I think when you look at the waste that we're producing, it's increasing significantly, and there's a lot of value locked up in that waste. So if we're not able to recover it, we're almost missing out on the potential to mine very valuable materials from our own waste. I would also want to bring in, I think there's a business logic. If you can decouple the value that you provide to the customer from the goods or the services that you're physically providing, I think that really touches on a sort of business logic that really hits at the heart of sustainability. So for example, as a car company, it's not necessarily that I sell you a car, but I sell you mobility services. And as a company, that allows me actually to maintain ownership of the car, but of course I can provide you the service of mobility in a variety of circumstances that you might need. And that's a very slight difference, but that's actually really at the core of circular economy thinking.
Matthew Fraser is with Circle Economy, based in Amsterdam, and he joined us from Sao Paulo, Brazil.
In cities around the world, certain sounds become iconic.
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
If you've been to New York, you probably recognize that immediately. It's the subway. Well, today, the world's TV's Isaiah kicks off a series on the sounds of Mexico City and the stories behind them, starting with a simple call from street vendors that's become part of the city's identity.
With 22 million residents, Mexico City can be very noisy. But in all of this chaos, there is one sound that any resident here would recognize.
Se compra colchones, tambores, refrigeradores, estufas.
It's a recording used by scrap metal collectors across the city. They drive from neighborhood to neighborhood, picking up bulky items people want to get rid of. The girl on the recording says, "We buy mattresses, refrigerators, stoves, washing machines, microwaves, or any old scrap metal you have." And if you've lived in any of Mexico City's 2,000 neighborhoods, you've probably heard this call a lot. The message is turning 20 years old, and I caught up with a woman who recorded it.
Pues el pregón empezó cuando yo tenía 9 años. Mi papá,
Marimar Terrón was only 9 years old when her dad, who was a scrap metal collector, asked her to record the message.
Mi papá me dijo, "Oye, ayúdame porque yo pues me canso."
Marco Antonio Terrón wanted to advertise his services without losing his voice shouting all day as he drove around. So he thought his daughter's voice would help him attract more people. And he wasn't wrong.
Teníamos un como estéreo chiquito y mi papá metía ahí los cassettes para hacer grabaciones.
She recalls spending 4 hours recording the message at home with a cassette deck. Then Terrón attached the tape to a megaphone and started playing the message during his daily rounds. Soon after, other scrap dealers became interested in the recording.
Ya después papá iba y quemaba en el internet discos.
Terrón digitized the tape and started selling CD copies for the equivalent of $1. And suddenly, Marimar's voice became the unofficial anthem for scrap collectors across Mexico City. And the cry spread way beyond local streets. It's on TV shows and ads. It's been incorporated into all sorts of songs. Even remixed into DJ sets and pop songs. There was even a version in English to appeal to American expats living in Mexico City. The scrap metal call also showed up at the Men's Soccer World Cup in Qatar when a Mexican fan played it on a huge speaker as he was walking the streets. And Netflix recently set it to music for the Oscar-nominated movie Emilia Perez.
Se compran colchones, tambores.
But despite this widespread popularity, the Terrón family initially missed out on any financial benefits because they hadn't trademarked the recording.
De hecho, el pregón está registrado desde ya hace bastante tiempo atrás. Pero legalmente no.
In 2013, they finally secured the rights. But Marimar says enforcing copyrights in Mexico is expensive, time-consuming, and rarely successful. So it's been difficult to make a profit. Her father still works as a scrap collector, just like an estimated 5,000 others in the Mexico City metro area. One of them is Genaro Viña. He says this is a tough job. You have to carry heavy things like mattresses and furniture. They operate informally and have to split the earnings with a helper, plus pay for gas. And after a full day of work, Viña usually takes home around $20 or $25 per day. He says it's barely enough to eat. Some of his colleagues are advertising in places like Facebook Marketplace, and fewer scrap dealers are doing rounds in the city. That means in the future, this iconic sound might even disappear. But for now, the jingle continues to be part of Mexico City's daily rhythm, making the city unmistakably itself. For the world, I'm Tibi Saicea, Mexico City.
On Monday, TV will bring us another iconic sound from Mexico City, the sound of the city's crank-powered organ grinders. In Canada, the demise of iconic department store, the Hudson's Bay Company, has come as a blow to many. The company has been around since 1670, and its growth and expansion are intertwined with Canadian history and the history of Canada's First Nations. The company is now in the process of liquidating its assets and plans to auction off 4,700 company artifacts to settle its debts. That is not going over well with people like Cody Grote. He teaches history and Indigenous studies at Western University in Ontario and is a member of the Kanyakahaka or Mohawk Nation. Grote says First Nations in Canada played a critical role in the growth and success of the Hudson's Bay Company.
One thing that we recognize with the Hudson's Bay relationship now is that it was interacting with upwards of 40 distinct First Nations in what we now call Canada. Each had their own cultural practices, each had their own political systems, and that obviously informed the relationship with the company, and it's going to inform how we approach things today as the company is starting to close down.
Can you give me just one example of how the company interacted with, you know, one First Nation community? What kind of technology transfer, as you said, was happening?
Sure. So, I mean, we have some iconic examples in the far north, for instance, where we have technologies such as snowshoes. We also have political relationships that developed quite distinctly on Vancouver Island, just off the coast of British Columbia, where we had the Hudson's Bay Company in the early to mid-1800s working as sort of a semi-sovereign state, where it was negotiating treaties with various First Nations along the Pacific coast. And some of those treaties were foundational to Canada's later efforts to assert sovereignty in what is now North America. So there's periods of time when the Hudson's Bay Company was acting as a government in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And that relationship was shaping how Canada was going to play out in its own future. And that's really why we're looking at this relationship, this company shutting down, and asking ourselves, what is the influence of the Bay and how should we approach its closure?
The Bay being the Hudson's Bay Company.
Correct.
Right. So tell me more about why some people are opposed to the company auctioning off all these artifacts and other holdings.
It's really an interesting question because when we look at some of these cultural items that might be for sale, it's a lot of their private corporate assets that they collected over several hundred years of being in operation. And some of these items that the Hudson's Bay Company might be perceiving as art, we know that some First Nations or Inuit communities in the north might recognize as cultural items or sacred items for ceremony or cultural practices. And then we look specifically at some of the documentary records that the Hudson's Bay Company might want to auction off, such as their Royal Proclamation Charter. This was the document in 1670 that really established the Hudson's Bay Company as a company. It was signed by King Charles II, and it gave the Hudson's Bay Company the right to have sole corporate ownership over North America, these sort of semi-sovereign powers in what is now Canada. And because of that document, we saw attempts to erase Indigenous political sovereignty in what is now Canada. So this document might be the founding document for a business that can be sold now as a private asset. But at the same time, that same record had this really prevalent role in trying to abolish Indigenous sovereignty. So we have other parties who are contesting this idea that it can and should be sold to a private individual or to a private corporation.
So are there alternate solutions that people are proposing for what should happen to these artifacts?
When this process first started with the Hudson's Bay Company, they approached a judge of the Ontario Superior Court and they said, this is our plan to sell some of our assets in order to make money to pay off our debts. So they said they were going to sell off some of their stores, some of their intellectual property, and some of their assets, including works of art. Now, that really caused an uproar here in Canada. The Assembly of First Nations, the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs, museums, cultural centers began to assert that some of these items should not be put on public auction because of cultural or sacred values, or because they should be repatriated to respective First Nations. So the Ontario Superior Court Justice, who's overseeing this case, said that a strategy had to be developed for the art and artifact auction that would incorporate the perspectives of other interested parties, such as First Nations or museums, for instance. Now, we don't know what that consultation is going to look like, and we also don't know if consultation is actually going to have any weight or power to it. If this consultation consultation is going to actually allow for changes to be made to the auction process.
Cody, besides being a history professor, you're also the chair of the Canadian Commission for UNESCO Memory of the World Advisory Committee, quite the title there. Does that body have any influence over what happens to the Hudson's Bay collection?
Sure. So Memory of the World is an international commemorative designation overseen by UNESCO. And this is responsible for designating the most significant archival or documentary heritage collections in the world. Here in Canada, in 2007, the original records of the Hudson's Bay Company from 1670 to present were considered amongst the most significant archival records in the entire world. But the original Hudson's Bay Charter was not included in that commemorative designation because it was in private ownership at the time. It was held by the Hudson's Bay Company at their corporate headquarters in Toronto, Ontario. So now that there's this risk that this charter might enter private hands and it might be bought by a private collector, we as a Memory of the World Advisory Committee in Canada rearticulated our belief that this Royal Proclamation Charter deserves to be recognized as one of the most internationally significant records. Memory of the World doesn't have any legislative teeth to it. It can't really enforce that archival records be preserved, but it does have this international peer pressure. It encourages the public preservation and access to records. So we as a Memory of the World Advisory Committee expressed our concerns to the governor of the Hudson's Bay Company. That's the formal title of the CEO and the chair of the board. And those concerns entered into some court submissions to the Ontario Superior Court overseeing the case. And it did help build this idea that there needs to be public consultation before the art and artifact auction moves forward.
What is the timeline here for knowing whether or not this auction will go forward?
We know that a judge says there needs to be consultation, but there's not specifically articulated a timeline. I would assume that the company overseeing the Bay now is going to start to realize that consultation with various First Nations is going to be a lot slower process than they might like it to be. So we're going to see that interplay occur. The expediency, the need to quickly sell items versus the longer, slower consultation that First Nations might request.
Cody Grote teaches Indigenous Studies at Western University in Ontario and is a member of the Kanyakahaka or Mohawk Nation.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Parents show love for their children in lots of different ways, through words, of course, hugs and affection, special food or gifts, and even discipline.
Sometimes it's hard for children, even older ones, to fully understand what our parents are trying to express. That was definitely the case for Korean-American Isan Kim, after going through a terrifying experience with her dad. Here's how she explains it on Stories from the Stage.
It's the 80s, I'm 12 years old, and I'm sitting in the Korean church parking lot with my friend Andy, and he is ranting about his parents because he doesn't get along with them. And suddenly he blurts out, you know, Korean parents don't love their children as much as American parents do. Our parents just use us as workers. I'm completely offended, so I push back and I say, that's not true. He points his finger at me and he says, you'll see. And it comes at me like a curse. A few weeks later, I'm at the family hardware store with my father, and two customers walk in. And in just a matter of seconds, they whip out these guns. One pointed at my father, one pointed at me. Now, my father has endured armed robberies before, but this is my first time. So they drag us to the cash register where they order my father to fill a brown paper bag with all the cash in the register. But the problem is there isn't enough, and the robbers are angry. And so they keep repeating, that's it? Where's the rest? Where's the rest? And my father keeps repeating, there is no more. You have all. There's no more. No more. And every time they go back and forth, I feel the gun dig deeper into the back of my skull so that I have to tip forward. And finally, the gun moves from the back of my head to the side as if to give my father a better view. And the voice behind me says, I mean it, man. Get the rest now. And what follows is a steely silence so tense that I have to close my eyes. And in that time,
I imagine what it's going to feel like to have a bullet course through my brain, because I'm certain that's what's about to happen. And I'm also certain that my father is bluffing, because there is a stash of cash in the back, and I'm about to lose my life for it. And I don't know how much time passes, but eventually the robbers give up. They push us in the back room and they leave. But for the days and weeks after, I completely freeze out my father. I can't forgive him for taking that kind of chance with my life. And I begin to wonder if maybe Andy was right. Maybe Korean parents have a lesser capacity for love. Maybe my classmates were right, and that my parents were alien and abnormal. And my father's not helping here, because he too is distant and silent this whole time, and all he does is jot down these numbers on a notepad, and I keep thinking it's because he's worried about the money we've lost, because that's what he really cares about. And we carry on like this until Thanksgiving. That's when my father wakes up early and he gathers us up and takes us to the hardware store on a day where it's usually supposed to be closed. And he ushers us inside, locks the door behind us, and flips on the lights. And there, leaning against one of the side walls, are six long countertop slabs wrapped in brown craft paper. And he goes up to the first one and he rips a corner off, revealing a 1-inch thick piece of glass. And he taps on it and he says, "Bullet not go through. Each piece, $1,000. Now, the math is not hard here, and I'm amazed at where my father was able to find $6,000. And I'm even more amazed about where he was able to find bulletproof glass. But there's no time to ask him, because he immediately gets to work. He whips out that notepad with all the figures on it, takes out a circular saw, pulls out a measuring tape, and he measures and cuts and measures and cuts for 36 hours straight. And at the end of it, he stretches his stiff back, sweat pouring down his neck, drenching his t-shirt, and we all look at what he's made. And it is a wonder. It is a wall, floor to ceiling, and countertop and cabinetry made entirely of bulletproof clear glass. And it's so pristine and new that it looks like spring water compressed. And he turns to me and he says, "Go inside." So I push open this door that he's made and framed, and I step inside, and I feel like I'm entering this sci-fi world. And I close and lock the door behind me, and I step back. And I see my father and the rest of my family, and really the rest of the world behind them beyond the storefront, through this clear, bulletproof glass. And honestly, my 12-year-old self kept thinking, my father has made a piece of Wonder Woman's invisible jet, right? It is the most cool thing that I have ever imagined that he would ever be able to do. And as I'm kind of wrapped in the awe of all of this, he finds this little opening that he's made so that we can interact with the customers, and he sneaks his hand through and he tickles me, and I jump back, and it's the first time we laugh in weeks. And he goes in for another, but this time I'm too far back and he can't reach, so he's just grasping air. And he leans into the little opening so his lips are there, and he says, "See? Nobody can touch." And that line is like a spell that makes everything clear. And I realize it didn't matter what Andy said, didn't matter what my classmates said, and it didn't matter why my father took that chance with my life. But what matters is what I know now. And at this very time, I know what love looks like. I know what love feels like. And it's unmistakable. And so I step forward, unlatch the locks, and open the door wide. And I bring my father and the rest of my family inside with me. Thank you.
That was Isan Kim telling her story on Stories from the Stage from our GBH partners at World TV.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a great weekend. We'll see you again on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Kelsen Foundation, Roman Mars, Gavin Selmanese, LLC, the Schmidt Family Foundation, Ed and Lillian Schneider. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.